The hour, 1 o'clock, having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the House Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. We have a quorum. And has anybody checked over the minutes from the meeting last Wednesday? Representative Jacob?
I have looked at the minutes, and I would move approval.
Thanks, Representative. Having heard the motion, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. The agenda and the minutes of last meeting have been approved. We have a full agenda. We have one bill on the docket and a couple of informational situations. First bill up is Vice Chair Smith. And Representative, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair Anderson. I move House File 3692 to be laid over in this committee.
Representative Smith, present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill, 3692. This is a straightforward but really important bill and program that I'm happy to bring and ask for an extension to. The Farmer Lender Mediation Program supports farmers who are facing financial distress and sometimes even a crisis. Maybe they suffered an injury, or their spouse mismanaged funds, there's a crop loss, equipment failure, or they just got behind. For whatever reason, they're facing a lender who is enforcing a debt that they have taken on. Under Minnesota law, if a bank, machinery dealer, or other lender seeks to enforce a debt against a farmer, that farmer has the right to choose mediation. In that 90-day mediation, both parties work with a trained facilitator to find a path forward, and this is an incredibly successful program. In nearly 90% of the over 1,700 mediations completed last year, the two parties reached a mutually agreeable solution. Maybe the operation needed to change, maybe some of the land needed to be sold, but in many cases, these farmers are able to manage that debt and, most importantly, keep farming. It's not hyperbole to say that this program saves farms in Minnesota. This bill extends the program for an additional 5 years. There's no policy changes. It's just ensuring that programs can count on this program that is being utilized currently, helping them in the years ahead. We have some great testifiers, Chair, so I'll leave it at that and have them speak about the bill and the program.
Thanks, Representative Smith. And you mentioned an important bill, and have to say one of the shortest bills I've seen around here in a while. It's one line, one change to a date, so thank you for bringing it forward. We'll begin our testifiers. Are we ready? Our first testifier, through the magic of whatever, is with us this morning. And go ahead, ma'am, and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I'm Mary Nell Preisler. I'm the director of the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. This has been going since 1986. And what it does is it steps in between farmers and their lenders or Main Street and see if we cannot do something other than a bankruptcy or a foreclosure. We are very successful in this program. If people request mediation, about 89% reach a workout. Now, that workout might not be that it's going to remain the same because everyone's going to have to make some changes. So there's changes that have to be made both on the side of the producer and of the creditor. Last year, we had 2,184 mediation notices. This is that we are on the federal year, so therefore ours go October 1st. Of those, 1,747 completed mediation. We had many of those that they did settle, but they settled just before the mediation. And that does seem to hurry people on to a settlement other than going through the 90 days of mediation. We had 992 that did settle in some way or another before mediation. So we think that this is a very good program. You have received a sheet. It's called Executive Summary of Program Results for 2025. You received that in your packet. And that will tell you, break it down to where it goes according to the Minnesota Agricultural Statistical Districts. And so you can see where it is within your district, what percentage of your producers are having some problems. Also shows you the kind of creditors. Now, it used to be years ago, it was implement companies, but now it is banks. And most of these are hometown banks. And then you can see where it divides up into other branches of creditors. The total amount that we dealt with last year was $166 million. And you can see how that is broken down to your banks and your AgStar, Compeer, and all of their programs, and also with FSA, USDA. We not only mediate mandatory mediation, which is underneath this statute, but we also mediate on the federal level for, we call it National Appeals Division mediation. And that's if you've been turned down by a program within USDA that can be anything from CRP, it can be the programs, it can be wetlands. We mediate all of those too. So they are in with these numbers. The primary commodity, I thought it would be dairy, but it wasn't. It's crops. And a lot of that is that we have such a change in our exchange policies with other nations that's really, really affecting the producers. The price of fertilizer, price of oil, all of that has made it very difficult to get a cash flow that works. The bottom is probably the most interesting because we continue to have borrowers that are sole proprietors and they're over 60. They have not turned the farm over to another generation. And also it is, now we have some farms that are huge that have thousands of acres of land, but we have a lot of them that aren't. And so the average was 581 acres, which coincides quite well with the Farm Business Management statistics. The parties in mediation, the parties retain control, and they can make the decisions for themselves instead of having the legal system make their decisions for them. I put together just a 3-month survey of what has happened from October 1st until January 30th. We are averaging a monthly amount of people in notes that are in mediation of 757 per month. That's what it comes out to. It is definitely continuing to rise, and I look toward that it will be more because we're getting more mediation notices and requests in the program. Are there any questions?
Ms. Preissler, thank you, and we will keep you there and go to member questions for you right now. Any members of the committee have questions? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good presentation. I'm thinking back to last fall with FarmAid, and I believe that there was a discussion about farmer lender mediation there, and that some of the grants from FarmAid go to farmer lender mediation. Is that correct, or do you receive any money from FarmAid?
Ms. Preissler?
Representative Hansen, no, we do not receive any money whatsoever from FarmAid. However, the Farm Advocate Program with the Department of Agriculture can give out food vouchers, so we direct them there. But we do not, for our budget, receive anything from the FarmAid.
Any further questions from members? Ms. Preissler, thank you for your work with this program. You say it began in 1986. Were you with the program then? Have you been with the program since its inception?
I have, and I don't know which representative that was.
That's Chair Anderson.
Oh, Chair Anderson. Okay. I have been with the program before it was even a program. I was on the pilot, and that was 1985.
Well, congratulations, and the program has done very well. It's served an excellent purpose, and you're to be congratulated, and thank you for your work over the years.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Very good. Thank you. We'll move on now to further testifiers, Commissioner Peterson. Then we have Hunter Peterson and Stu Laurie on deck to testify on this House File 3692.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Peterson, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Just briefly want to express our support for this program. It's really important that the, you know, the department works really closely with our 11 farm advocates that we have around the state. And I always take this pitch to remind legislators that, you know, because you'll get calls from farmers that have a, you know, have a hard time. And one of their first calls a lot of times is to our advocates, and that's a free confidential call. So when farmers are struggling or having a hard time, and then the advocates actually can work closely with the mediator. They also can, attend and help in the mediations if it goes to a full-blown mediation. So it's a really important piece that fits well into that. I myself personally will get invited by the farmer to sit in a mediation. And I've seen so many farms save because what the advocates do and what mediators do a lot of times is just buy time, which is really important because it's hard to figure out, you know, the situation. At a farm just this last week, I've been working on for a couple of months, and they got their foreclosure notice last Wednesday, and were able to file that, and they'll be going to mediation. Again, very, you know, unique situations on these. It's not always just the commodities there. As was said by the vice chair, is a lot of times it's healthcare. In this case, it was a lawsuit that was a disagreement, and I think mediation will be able to solve this particular case and help us keep our farms, because we saw last week, you know, the numbers come out that we lost, 1,000 farms over the last 2 years. So appreciate your consideration, but I wanted to emphasize that unique piece. We're working closely with the advocates. And then to Representative or Chair Hansen's question, it was Farmers Legal Action Group gets quite a bit of money. Farmers Legal Action Group has always manned the hotline or provided dollars since the 80s to FLAG's legal hotline. So farmers can call and, again, get free legal advice, and that goes well into connecting them sometimes with an advocate moving into mediation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner? Seeing none, our two other testifiers want to step up. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. For the record, my name is Hunter Peterson, and I am the Public Policy Specialist with Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. On behalf of our 30,000 family farm and ranch members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3692. Farm Bureau supports farmer lender mediation and extending the program. Credit is a key financing tool for the vast majority of farmers out there, but in a difficult farm economy like the one that we're facing right now, some of those folks end up struggling to manage their debt. And data from MDA demonstrates that requests for mediation are up. This program buys farmers time, like Commissioner Peterson said, and it gives them options on how to manage their debt instead of having to just declare bankruptcy or go into foreclosure. And so extending this program now would be timely, and it will save family farms. So I'd like to thank Representative Smith for bringing the bill forward. I'd like to thank the committee for hearing it and would urge your support, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Hunter Peterson? Seeing none, thank you. Last testifier, at least on our list here, is Mr. Laurie. Go ahead and identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And on behalf of our members, I'm glad to share our strongest support for Rep. Smith's bill to extend farmer lender mediation. This is a top priority for us. When our members met in November, they named addressing the economic crisis in farm country the top priority for our organization for the coming year, and extending and strengthening the farmer lender mediation program was a top request within that. I think we're still waiting to get the latest data from Farm Business Management. Maybe we'll hear some from the director there in a moment, but we know 2024 was the lowest farm income since the 1990s. I talked to our vice president the other day. She was working with her Farm Business Management instructor, and of the farms that he's worked with and done their look back for the year, he guessed about 10% were cash flowing for the upcoming year. So the economic strain is real, and this program really matters. When it comes to stabilizing the farm economy, you've only got so many tools in your toolbox. You don't get a vote on tariffs. You don't get a vote on trade, but you can extend this program. Just a couple stories talking about buying time. I think about a member who shared their story with me. They were a dairy farmer. They hurt their back. Dairy farming is labor intensive, particularly the way he was doing it. He couldn't keep dairying, and he had a creditor, a large lender, coming in and pushing him. Mediation bought him that time. He was able to sell that dairy herd. He's raising beef cattle today. Another farmer going into harvest realized her spouse had got them deep into a debt, unbeknownst to her. She was out there defending their equipment, making sure that it wasn't repoed during the night in order to get that crop off. Again, she's farming today. It doesn't look in the same way, but she's farming today. So from what we hear from our members, it is not hyperbole to say that this program saves farms. And we appreciate Representative Smith's work on it. We appreciate your work today and hope it earns your support.
Thanks, Mr. Laurie. Any questions from members? Seeing none, I would also add that we don't get a vote on things like weather either.
That's true, too. Yes.
Anybody in the audience who would care to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, final comments, Vice Chair Smith.
I think our testifier said it well. This is a climate of uncertainty, and it's always been uncertainty for farmers, as you mentioned, Chair Anderson, with things like weather. And this is something where we can provide some stability at the state level for our farmers. So happy to put this in front of the committee.
With that, House File 3692 is laid over. Thanks, Vice Chair Smith.
Thank you.
And next up, we're going to have a informational hearing on a great program that we have here at the state called the AGREET program. And whomever is going to come up first, we have Bev Durgan and others, Dean Brian Boer. So come on up, get your technical things in order, and we will begin hearing from you. Dean Bergen, you seem to be first, so identify yourself and proceed for the committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension, and I am joined today by two of my colleagues, Dean Burr, who is the Dean of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, and Dean Laura Mogard, who is the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Today we are here to discuss the Agricultural Research, Education, Extension, and Technology Transfer Program. That's a lot to say, so we refer to it as AGREET. So, and that's what we'll refer to today. For those of you that are not familiar with the AGREET program, it was established by the legislature in 2015. And this funding at the time that it was established, one of the priorities from the group that moved this legislation forward was to increase the capacity of the three colleges that we have here today. And when I talk about capacity, I mean human capacity. Many of you are familiar with our colleges, are familiar with Extension, and that you know that the work of our colleges, the research and Extension, is conducted by our faculty and educators. If we don't have faculty and if we don't have educators, this work doesn't get done. So investing in the human capital, our infrastructure, our faculty, educators, and graduate students increases the capacity of our three colleges to address some of the pressing issues in agriculture in Minnesota. This next slide gives you an indication of where the funding that is currently in AGREET is used for. The very first line there is the AGREET capacity funding. That's close to $5 million. That's the funding that we use to pay salaries and fringe and support of our faculty, educators, and the graduate students that help conduct the research and extension. The next few lines that you could see that are also in maroon are that is funding that is also at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to just talk a little bit about the second line there, which is the rapid response funding. All of us know that, and we just talked about with the Farmer Lender Mediation Program, a lot of things happen in agriculture that we can't predict and we can't control. We have issues around flooding, we have issues around drought, we have issues around avian influenza, and this rapid response funding helps our faculty and our educators to address these issues in a very timely manner. So when we talk about the work that is done at the University of Minnesota in supporting agriculture, we need two things. We need the faculty, the educators, and the graduate students to conduct the work, but we also need the funding to support those programs. And as you can see that the rest of the programs there that are listed there are programs that support the work that the faculty and educators do. The last two lines is supporting programs that are not located at the University of Minnesota, though they are programs that we do collaborate with, especially Extension. I haven't mentioned yet, but I did want to mention, is that when AGREET was established, there was an advisory panel that was established with AGREET. And the three deans here work very closely with that advisory panel to determine what the priorities are for the funding. So as you can see on this slide, we have a number of just overarching areas where we have placed the funding for AGREET, anywhere from crops and livestock production, advancing soil fertility, water quality, precision agriculture, nutrient management, up to technology transfer. So these are areas that we have agreed with, that we have listened to the advisory panel, and where we are putting AGREET funding. One of the impacts of AGREET funding is that it has enabled the three colleges to work across colleges and to hire joint faculty. So if we look at CFANS, there's currently 18 faculty in that college, and several of them have joint extension appointments. There's six faculty in the College of Veterinary Medicine, and we have 11 extension educators. So with that, we are able to work across colleges and to really address some of these big issues. Again, I will say avian influenza is an issue that just doesn't reside in one college. It works across these colleges, and the AGREET faculty have really enabled us to respond quickly to that issue. One other thing that the advisory panel has asked us to do is to try to build capacity around issues. What we see at the University of Minnesota so often is we have one faculty member that is addressing a big issue. With the AGREET funding, we've been able to hire some strategic cohort hiring. And to our advisory panel, what they say that is to have a faculty member that is also linked to extension. So, for example, I just gave you one program, manure management. Manure management in Minnesota is an important way to protect water quality, but also to help farmers use that asset we have in Minnesota. So with the AGREET money, we've been able to hire a faculty member, Melissa Wilson, who is in CFANS, that has a research extension appointment, and an extension educator who is located at our Morris Regional Office, which is also the West Central Research and Outreach Center. So we've been able to conduct the research, work with the extension educator, and to be able to deliver that research directly to farmers very quickly. So this team has really developed a comprehensive manure management program throughout the state. So AGREET has been very effective in bringing the work of our three colleges together and having us be able to respond to some of these major issues in Minnesota. So with that, I am going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Mogard.
Go ahead, Dean.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, members. So my name is Laura Mulgard. I'm the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and I am also a veterinarian myself. And I'm going to be sharing some additional perspectives about how AGREET helps us safeguard animal health in Minnesota. So as many of you know, the livestock industry is a cornerstone of the state's economy. For example, our state is number one in turkeys and number two in hogs and pigs, and that is nationally. So those are just two examples of why this is so important. Emerging global diseases and evolving food safety challenges create risks for Minnesotans and for our ag economy. High path avian influenza, as Dr. Durgan said, is one example of these threats and the impact it has had on our producers. AGREET helps support scientists and educators who safeguard animal health and protect our economy and food supply, while also improving production efficiency. AGREET has supported researchers who have created rapid diagnostics, improved animal health, informed biosecurity practices, and precision nutrition. And I'll let Dean Boer talk in a bit about the economics of this, but these researchers have been very successful in getting grant funding to support this work. So this is a wonderful investment for the state. AGREET helps Minnesota's beef, dairy, swine, and poultry producers efficiently raise these herds and flocks while ensuring the safety and sustainability of our food supply. Next slide. I'm going to share a little bit about the university's new strategic roadmap, Elevate Extraordinary 2030, and its strong focus on One Health. Now, One Health is a concept that recognizes that the health of animals, people, and the environment we share are closely linked and interdependent. And One Health is an integrated approach that aims to sustainably balance the health of people, animals, and ecosystems. And as Dean Durgan said, these colleges work very closely together in doing this already, and due to in no small part to AGREET funding. This strategic roadmap elevates the university's ability to integrate this One Health approach and advance it to generate solutions that promote resilient communities, sustainable food systems, and healthy ecosystems for the future of Minnesota and the world, and to identify and respond to emerging and contemporary infectious diseases. And we do that through collaborative research, surveillance, and rapid response strategies that are across these animal species and plant species and sectors. And to accelerate the advancement of sustainable and secure food systems by integrating cutting-edge innovations in precision agriculture, plant science, and animal health. And finally, I'm going to just share a few examples from our College of Veterinary Medicine, because that is where I work. So environmental intelligence, monitoring the environment to stop pathogens before they reach the farm gate. For example, AGREET faculty are working to track how prions survive in the soil for 16 plus years and to protect agricultural land and the food supply. They're mapping how hyperlocal virus adaptations threaten livestock. Modernizing agricultural biosecurity systems, creating a unified data-driven radar for Minnesota's agriculture. For example, the work of AGREET faculty is replacing a 1980s era diagnostic paradigm with a modern variant nomenclature, which sounds like buzzwords, but it allows our producers to communicate effectively with veterinary diagnostic labs using the same language when an outbreak occurs. And the research is proving that standard hygiene, like showering out after leaving a swine barn, does protect farm families from occupational microbe exposure. Breakthrough therapeutics and farmside diagnostics are another example, moving high-tech laboratory power directly to the farm for real-time results. Our AGREET faculty are deploying 24-hour field kits to confirm and eliminate devastating threats like the New World screwworm. They're developing prophylactic compounds like Tetralon E to block parasites in calves before symptoms occur. And they're strengthening animal resilience and welfare using genetics and microbiology to create a naturally hardier livestock population. For example, AGREET faculty are identifying beneficial bacteria that naturally crowdsource out mastitis, reducing antibiotic dependency in dairy. and they are using machine learning to predict swine virus variants a full year before they emerge. Dean Boer.
Dean Boer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us today. It's a delight to be here with my colleagues to talk about AGREET. It's been a mainstay of our programs for about almost 11 years now, so we appreciate the support for that. I was asked to talk a little bit about the economic impacts as it boils down to what's the value of this to Minnesota. I will point out that as we do this work, as Dean Durgan mentioned, there are 87 extensions every all 87 counties in Minnesota. In addition, in my role, I serve as the director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station, which includes our 10 research and outreach centers. And so at the end of the day, all of the work from AGREET through extension, through our research and outreach centers, through the researchers that are working with producers and others, all of that extends out into Minnesota and gets into the place where it has the most impact. As part of that, this $4.9 million that Dean Durgan mentioned, that's leveraged $27 million in grants, just this $28 million almost just this last year for faculty doing research. Those grants, we included extramural grants. They're not coming all from the state or something like that. So they're actually developing and allowing us to go out and compete for those grants, both the federal level and with other businesses and industry as we try to deliver these results. So it's a key part of driving an example of where the state's initial investment, when Dean Durgan was talking about capacity, allows us to get those grants that are project specific that can address the needs that are relevant at that time in the areas and the farmers that find it most useful. As you look at that, since 2016, when we had the first awards and first hires made, there's been $92 million in sponsored projects, those grant projects coming to Minnesota that we're drawing into the state to support our farmers and agriculture. And for example, the ROI on that, of course, from AGREET is 2.3 times the investment of the state of Minnesota, so about a 230% return in investment from that work. And that's not including, you may have seen at times a comment that the returns to agricultural research in Minnesota are 40 to 1. And people find that number hard to believe, except that when we develop a new variety of grains, a new variety of corn, we address a disease like prions, for example, we address disease in livestock. That has carry forward returns for years and years after that. So it's a recurring return. Every time you turn that crop over, there's a recurring return to that. So extraordinary returns to this work that's critical for the sustainability of Minnesota's agriculture. Just some examples of impact on this. One of the areas that has multiple dimensions to this work frequently is precision agriculture, which you hear a lot about now with AI and so on. But our abilities to understand at a geoscale level what's happening on that farm and what's happening to water quality, what's happening to the productivity, how are we seeing the impacts of nitrogen, for example, in the use and productivity of crops, is advancing tremendously. And Yujin Mao is the faculty member identified here, working with AI technologies, satellite imagery, to be able to identify how do cropping systems and nutrient management in particular affect our crop productivity, and how can we manage that more effectively to reduce our footprint in the environment. And Dean Mulgar is talking about One Health, that idea of whatever we do with our food system comes back to our land, comes back to our waters, and how can we do that more sustainably and more effectively as an enterprise. It certainly does also increase profitability. Farmers are more able to use and precisely use fertilizer and nutrient applications, whether it's crop pest management applications. To do that work, it saves them money, helps them be more financially viable, and again, it improves our natural resources and our sustainability. And one of those things always we're looking at is how do we preserve and protect our water resources in Minnesota through those technologies. So being able to really precisely manage the aspects of that enterprise is a key part of that work. I will point out there's actually a national NSF Foundation grant that we received as part of that work in precision agriculture that works across the College of Science and Engineering. CFANS, CBM's part of that, Extension's part of that work. That's a broad scope of looking at Minnesota and how do we adapt precision ag in a state that has widely variable conditions in agriculture that we try to manage and adapt to the most productive uses. We haven't talked much about our students, and of course AGREET, as we have faculty and the capacity for that, a lot of that is around our student training. Another part of this is, in this slide, carries a lot with it, it connects us with industry. And we see industry as partners in being at the frontier of how are we delivering our research oftentimes, right? We're that place that starts to do that research, that gets into industry. Of course, they go out and deliver it to producers and get it onto the landscape. This is an example where if you're familiar with cheese making or butter making, one of the co-products of that is whey proteins. And whey proteins are very popular right now, and protein in diet is very popular with people, of course, as part of a nutritional component. One of the elements of whey protein is there's relatively few uses for it. There's a large volume of it. How do you make value out of that? This team of students working our Dairy Foods Research Center, our Midwest Dairy Foods Research Center, which is also a joint program with the state of Minnesota, helps to support that. And our food pilot lab developed a yay toast, which is a whey protein brown sugar product that you can put on toast that tastes really good, but it's also super nutritious. So if kids are having toast for breakfast before they go to school, they put some of this whey protein on it. You get a high protein boost from that, helps stay through the day. And they developed this at our research center. And the faculty member, Dr. Amam Charla, who leads the Minnesota Dairy Foods Research Center, was key to mentoring those students to bring that product to market. So a full cycle, next generation, doing the research and bringing a product out in the community that helps our dairy farmers' economy as well. One thing about this is I was tempted to use Neil Young's song, Rust Never Sleeps, but many people are probably too young to know Neil Young, speaking of Farm Aid, for example, earlier. But the $4.9 million that was allocated in 2015, tremendously impactful. If you look at the purchasing power of that today, of course, we just inherently have inflation in our economy. That's about $3.1 million now. And so actually with the GREET now, in many cases, we are supporting those faculty, those researchers we have in place from a GREET to continue their work forward. So that's coming from other funds that we either raise through our grants and projects or through other sources of funding that we try to identify to do that. And so we are looking over time at how do we, and I use this farm field example, how do we keep that money on that activity that we're looking for? How do we support that research going forward and do that impactfully so that we erode that capacity of our research to be able to do that delivery for our farmers in the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back, and I think we'll entertain any questions that might be here.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. First is Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about my voice. Last week we had a testifier here who said in kind of a general way one of the main bullets for long-term success in agriculture was going to be to bring animals back to the land. It's just kind of a broad, you know, if we can bring animals back to the land, it's going to help a lot with agriculture. So my first question then, I will have just three of them. How do you feel about this? Number two, how widespread could it become? Number three, then what could we do to support it if indeed it's a legitimate thing and actually could be scalable? Thank you.
Who is your question directed to or any of them?
Whoever knows it.
Okay. Who gets the short straw here?
Chair Anderson, member, yes, we support diversification in agriculture. That we know that farms that are diversified tend to be able to weather some of these issues that we're seeing right now. So we have a number of programs at the University of Minnesota and a collaboration with my partner colleges here. One is supporting new and beginning farmers. So we work with the Department of Ag, and we know that new farmers, beginning farmers, they are actually more open to looking at a diversified farm, so adding livestock to that enterprise, you know, everywhere from dairy goats to adding sheep to also looking at specialty beef. So we are very much interested in that. We also are looking at, you know, adding additional programs in grazing and how do you utilize, you know, grazing with animals on that farm. And then also, you know, my most favorite word here, manure. You know, that adds manure to, you know, to the overall cropping system that, again, increases the soil health and also helps to, again, decrease to reduce the cost for that farmer. So many of those programs, and also, you know, we're looking right now, we have a program on farm transitions. We have over 400 couples in our farm transition program right now. We have lots of land that is going to be turning over in Minnesota. And so how do we make sure that that land is moving to new farmers, new beginning farmers, and helping them to think about how do you manage risk on that landscape? And one of that is diversification.
Follow-up, Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a little surprised. I was at a corn farm outside of Manoman before session. They let me help with the corn harvest. In other words, I did the last pass at the combine picking up the corn. But then they talked about cover crops, and they talked about the grazing and the manure management, and I was pretty impressed. I didn't know that it was quite to that extent and that it could maybe be reproduced into other farms in the area, but they had a really tight operation. Nothing went to waste. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have any response to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you wreck anything?
Say again?
When you ran that combine, did you wreck anything?
I just rode in it. But it was nice.
Okay. Very good. Anybody want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I'll pick up the mic there for Bev. A couple of programs related to that. So West Central Research Outreach Center, for example, has the country's only organic and conventional dairy on the same site. And it is focused on primarily grazing crops and using photovoltaics. So it's basically trying to get to a zero footprint on dairy, for example, in a pasture-based system. Another element to that is there's a pasture-based system where you take the animals to the pasture. We're also, in a sense, taking the pasture to the animals. So you'll hear shortly from the Forever Green Initiative that's looking at your row crop farmer integrating perennial crops, winter annual crops onto the landscape where you're covering this, you're getting the benefits of, for example, alfalfa in a forage grazing system, but also bringing that into as you harvest the grains and the forage from the Forever Green crops, you bring that to the animals. So you're getting that benefit on the landscape through those technologies. So when Dean Durgan talks about diversification, part of it is there's kind of an agriculture, there's no one-size-fits-all system. You know, how do we take advanced knowledge? And in fact, some of the work in Forever Green is Nagreet's program. So we're looking at all the dimensions, and that's one of the benefits, I think, of the university, is we take those broad opportunities. Where do you find innovation, where do you see that, and bring them forward and try to test them out and move them forward more effectively and efficiently? Ideally, they become the things that farmers can adopt, be more productive, more profitable, and enhance their families as well, so environmentally. So, great question.
Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this presentation. It's really enlightening. I wanted to quick ask about some things on the slide that related to leveraging state funds to grow Minnesota's economy. That's the name of the slide. You know, we see nearly $28 million in grants. You know, this biennium, over $92 million of grants since 2016. And then this metric here that, you know, the grants that the state of Minnesota has invested in Agreet has catalyzed 2.33 times the amount in other grants that Agreet has received. And these are great measures of how much investment is going into these programs, which I think is a valuable metric in and of itself. But I'm curious if you have any sort of sense of what a dollar in Agreet of investment in Agreet yields in economic development or growth or opportunity within our communities in economic output. So if, you know, does $1 invested in Agreet, you know, yield, for example, $4 of economic growth, something like that. Do you have any sort of metrics that might be able to speak to that aspect of this, of how Agreet contributes to Minnesota's economy? Thank you.
Dean Durgan or Boer?
Yeah, for sure. I was alluding to that in my presentation and probably went a little too fast, but we've done quite a bit of work on, in general, not specific to Agreet, what are the economic returns to agricultural R&D? And we look at that typically throughout the chain from the standpoint of, okay, what does it do for the farmer first? Because that's the first point of contact with developing a new crop, a new variety that's more productive. Secondly, what does that do for agribusinesses and communities, of course, because that farmer's more productive and more efficient, that's returns to that community as well. And then thirdly, if you go down that chain farther, what's the return on that to consumers? And I always go back to food, this sounds econ geeky, I'm sorry. Food is a regressive tax on consumers. Everybody has to eat. Poor people are, in fact, impacted more directly by low food production than other people. And so we have extensive work in that. And I mentioned the number that I use in Minnesota, and we have a faculty member, Phil Pardee, who does this research. The aggregate economic impact, that's the full value of agricultural research in general, is that 40-to-1 return on investment, which, again, seems very large and unbelievable in some cases. But it's that piece that because when we get these technologies, they're a recurring annuity based on our increased productivity. And now we think more about what's our environmental footprint from that, right? How do we reduce that environmental footprint? We actually have a program called Natural Capital Project that looks at water has a value. And there's some mechanisms to think about how do we help to ensure that we're taking care of our water through essentially, you know, credits, for example, like carbon credits, for example. So the impacts are huge to ag R&D. They simply are because of the necessities of food for humans.
Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. 40-1. That is a very, very sizable return on investment, so to speak. Last week we heard a lot about consolidation and monopolization, kind of within the agriculture industry, and so I just want to recognize that not all economic development or economic output is distributed evenly. And that I would be curious to see how much of the dollars invested in AGREET and agriculture R&D is to the benefit of specifically Minnesotans or Minnesotan farmers or small farmers, or that those are metrics that I'd be very, very interested in exploring a little bit further. Because if that 40-1 investment, if let's say, you know, the massive, massive conglomerates that we heard about last week are receiving, you know, the vast majority of that economic development and economic investment as part of AGREET and throughout that whole chain that you just discussed, then I don't know that it's accomplishing what we want it to. And so I don't know, I'm not being adverse to AGREET or anything like that. I just want to find out to make sure that our investments in this program are primarily going to the benefit of Minnesota farmers, of Minnesota workers, and members of the agricultural community in Minnesota. Thank you. Thank you.
There may be a comment coming there. Dean Durgan or anybody else care to comment?
No? I think that Chair Anderson, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
We have the capability of doing that. You know, I don't think we've been specific to that. We have economists in extension that do economic analysis for lots of things. You know, we just finished one on agritourism and the impact of agritourism on the economy. So that's something that, Chair Anderson, I will look into. You know, that will be a separate study that really to try to impact, to, you know, to look at this money and where, you know, along that chain that it's being used. I don't know whether it's possible. But I will talk to Bridget Tuck, our analyst, to see whether it's possible to do that. So, okay.
Very good. Thank you. And I would just add that, I don't think benefits to a lot of these things stop at the state border. For example, University of Illinois puts out some great things on financing with farmers. Purdue, it's a kind of a fraternity of ag research that helps all of agriculture. And, yes, our state does benefit. Representative Lawrence.
Chair Anderson, thank you so much. As a graduate of the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, I enjoyed the presentation today. Thank you for expounding on all the things that are going on at the U. It's neat to kind of get a recap of that as well. I've got one question. I'm going to reference back to page number 5 when you spoke on faculty. And just out of curiosity, are you fully staffed at this point in time? Are there openings that you're still trying to fill? Difficulty finding or placing those? And then are there any new positions that you foresee in the near future that would fall into this program?
Yeah, we probably just have a slightly different answer, but right now Mr. Chair, apologies. We do have positions out there, but typically right now we've used all the AGREET capacity funding for faculty, so we've reached what I call peak AGREET. Mm-hmm. And to that issue of, you know, when I was talking about the erosion of the value, will be gradually declining numbers. Overall, to your questions about, at least in CFAN's context, we're substantially, I won't get the number right, we're substantially fewer faculty in general over the last 15 years than 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so there is that generally we're starting to erode that capacity to do that research that we've been doing. And that's true to the points Chair Anderson made about other universities and so on work. We're not unique in that. Mm-hmm. Some of that is just federal funding numbers as well. And so we looked for more and more opportunities. That's why AGREET for Minnesota was such a huge benefit, because it did allow us, for the numbers of faculty that are on there, the employees on that, was huge. It was a game changer, where we frequently had other states that we meet with other land grants saying, how in the world did Minnesota do this? Mm-hmm. So it was had a tremendous impact. But like all this, it has to sort of continue and refresh through time.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Lawrence?
No follow-up question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vang has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of want to dig in a little bit more into like the technical process of how you guys decide or distribute the funds, working in tandem with like the advisory panel. Is there like a grant application process that these researchers will the faculty apply for to fund these projects, or are these some things that, yeah, I guess just if you could explain more about the process of how you guys decide where these funds go.
Dean Boer.
Mr. Representative Vang, that's a good question. These funds are geared specifically towards, as the common name, the human infrastructure side. So this, the advisory committee is key in us identifying, when Dean Dorgan was talking about identifying the areas of work we did, and those seven, you know, columns we had there, we put it as we wanted to do the most good for the most people. So we stayed away from very specific, you know, areas of research. We tried to keep it at water quality, at these broader issues related to. But once those funds are committed to faculty as tenured faculty at the University of Minnesota, those funds are committed for the extent those faculty are there in their careers. So when I said we're at peak agreement right now, that funding was done through consultation with the advisory group. And through time, we made those hires, as well as us, you know, presenting what our priorities were and listing also legislative priorities. Once that funding's committed to those faculty, like all of our funding that goes to faculty at the university, that's pretty well committed. So now when we have a person who leaves, for example, they may take another job or they retire, then those positions, those dollars come back in, and then we do another round of what are priorities, what are objectives, and to make those decisions. So there aren't specific recurring grants going into individual projects, for example. If you looked at the list of total funding, there are specific targeted funds in there, but those are different. Those are targeted to specific work being done as well.
Representative Vang.
Thank you for that. And just one more question. I know that I think some years ago we set aside some funding for the tribes to work on wild rice research, and I don't believe the dollars have been distributed yet. Can you explain why?
Yes.
Again, Dean, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vang. Yes, we had originally begun working with MIAC. So one of the elements behind that is, of course, there's also research on cultivated wild rice. And we committed, when we worked with the tribes, to engage with tribes on that work to identify what we would do with the funding that was from the conservation of wild rice, which is really critical in Minnesota due to climate change, environmental aspects, and stressors there. So actually this winter I've spent, and we started that shortly after it was appropriated. We worked with MIAC a bit. We ended up through that conversation going directly to tribes. So I've been going this winter traveling. We've been at Grand Portage, White Earth, we met with Leech Lake, Shakopee Mid-Washington Sioux. We have several others we're talking to. So we're going literally to the tribal DNRs and visiting with them about what are their priorities regarding conservation of wild rice so that we can get a handle on how do we do this in the best interest of tribal nations and their goals with it. And with the different nations, there's different interests and different goals and objectives. So we're going to be bringing that together and creating kind of a common proposal to say, okay, how do we do this in a way that we're supplementing their work through our work, but they're driving that research that's happening in their lands.
Representative Vang.
Okay. And so the, I guess the funds that have not been spent yet is because you guys are still working on the process of deciding how to work on the research, for example. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. No more, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it was last year, or maybe it was the year before, there was a bit of a kerfuffle about where all does the university get its money? You know, that there's a higher education committee. These funds come through this committee. And I believe there were members who tried to get an aggregate amount of what's the total amount of funding that comes into the University of Minnesota from various committees. So, and then we have bonding as well. So what, you know, maybe if you can just give a reason why these funds come from the Ag Committee, and then I have a follow-up after that question.
Dean Durgan? Or Dean Boer?
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, one of the things that Dean Boer talked about is that all of us are very much dependent on state, federal funding and also agreed funding. We know that the state and federal funding has not increased, I can start for extension, for the last 10 years. So our budgets have been, they've been stable but not increasing. We know that salary, we have to increase our salaries for our, of our educators and our faculty. So because of that, AGREET was really a brainchild of some of our ag leaders that were trying to get additional funding to support our three colleges that would support infrastructure. So with not increasing budgets for the university, for our colleges, this was a way to get additional funding for faculty. So it happened to come through this way, through the Department of Agriculture. As I said, it's very beneficial. You know, was it the best way? All I'm saying is that we're happy that we have it. And, you know, we, Department of Ag has worked with us, has been, you know, very supportive of our work and has given us support to do it. So that's kind of the history around that. And to, and still today, as Brian said, is that the number of extension faculty in agriculture and natural resources continues to decline because our budgets do not increase. The only way that we've been able to keep our graduate students and our faculty is through grants.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And follow-up, maybe following a dollar. You know, so if we appropriate a dollar to you, it goes to the fiscal agent with the Department of Ag, and then it goes to you. Is that correct?
Dean Boer?
Yeah, I'm sure that's correct.
And then Mr.
Chair Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and then so once it goes through, let's say an appropriation normally has a four-year cycle of before it has to be expended, but if they do a contract with you first and the dollar goes to you, how long do you have to spend it?
Dean Boer?
I'm not, Mr. Chair, not sure from the time we have that appropriated. I will say that right now we're spending all of the money in AGREET and we're adding money into it from other funds.
Chair Hansen, follow up?
Chair, maybe I'll go back to the Representative Vang question. So let's say that money came into the university for working with the tribes on wild rice. And if that was in 23, does that have to be expended by the end of 27, or do you have longer to work with that money?
Dean Boer.
Well, I think we have longer to work with it. We were trying to, as I said, it is absolutely critical that we work with the tribes to be able to expend that money in the interests of the conservation. Oh.
Somebody from the university may be able to give us a definitive answer on that. Well, Department of Ag, Mr. Huguenin. Thanks for stepping up. Identify yourself and help us.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. So this appropriation gets transferred to the Ag Fund, and so that Ag Fund money will stay there. So in this case, in terms of tribal research, while the university is working with tribes, looking for research topics, partners, et cetera, that money stays there. And then once it goes to the U, then they'll have a five-year window on that initial grant. But because it's in the Ag Fund, they've got the time it takes to figure out how to expend it best.
Thank you. Follow up, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just trying to provide some enlightenment here in terms of where a dollar goes. So stays in the Ag Fund within the Department of Agriculture. Let's say we appropriate for a grant or money gets transferred $5 million to the university. I'm assuming that collects interest until expended. Is that correct? What happens to the interest? Is that in the Ag Fund or is that in the university fund?
Mr. Huguenin, identify yourself. I didn't ask you that last time, and then answer, okay?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Huguenin, and I'm the director of the Ag Marketing and Development Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. You're correct, Chair Hansen, that because it's in the Ag Fund, it earns interest, and then by statute, that money is dedicated to the AGREET. So it's dedicated to the purposes of AGREET. So what we end up doing then is with that interest, we'll add that then to the contract with the University of Minnesota. So it stays within AGREET.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so then let's just use $5 million as an example. It takes a couple years to get done. Then it would be $5 million plus that gets transferred to the University of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Mr. Huguenin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct, yes. And it only, I should also add, it only earns interest while it's in the ag fund. So once we issue that contract to the University of Minnesota, and they've spent that, it doesn't accrue interest at that point. But.
Mr. Chair, and sorry for all these questions.
Chair Hanson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and then Mr. Savory, is that money tracked here, and do we have a record of how much interest is transferred for the program?
Mr. Savory, could you help us out?
Chair and members, by statute, the department in consultation with MMB puts together an ag fund statement every forecast, and that has the trackings of the actuals, current amount within the account, and the expected revenues and expenditures that would be coming in the next next four fiscal years. So you can see into the future the planned potential uses of it, as well as the revenues as well.
Chair Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we want to look at that. And maybe make that available. I know it is available to the committee. I do have a final question, and I referenced Farm Aid earlier, and I know that there has been a proposal for the University of Minnesota to become a repository of all Farm Aid material and collections for the last 40 years. Is that a bonding proposal? Is that a ag committee proposal? Is that a higher education proposal? Or is it currently just a dream?
Dean Durgan.
Chair Anderson, Representative Hanson, President Cunningham has indicated that they're very interested in looking at that particular, the St. Paul campus as a location for a history of Farm Aid. She has assigned now a Vice Provost, Scott Langdon, who is overseeing the renovation of the St. Paul campus and visiting for the St. Paul campus to oversee that. I had a conversation with Scott last week and connected him to some of the players within Farm Aid, and so those conversations are happening. So we're not at all at a stage of what Farm Aid would like, what it could possibly be on the St. Paul campus, but those conversations are definitely moving forward, at least, you know, thinking about, you know, visioning what that might look like in collaboration and when the new student center on the St. Paul campus is built, what that might look like.
Thank you, Chair Hanson. We have one more testifier, but I had a question for Dean Mulgaard. We had a veterinary question as well. We need more veterinarians, and you talked about your faculty doing a lot of this research. Do some of the students as well get involved in what's happening in terms of research with AGREET?
Chair Anderson, yes, thank you for that question. We have a program, this is one of several programs, but probably the most notable is Summer Scholars, where our students can do summer research programs with our veterinary faculty, including our AGREET faculty. And so, yes, our veterinary students can be involved in that research. Our graduate students are always paired with faculty in this research.
And how many students are in the Vet College of Veterinary Medicine?
Thank you for that question. We admit 105 in St. Paul, and then South Dakota State University and admits 20 more in a 2+2 program. Okay. So the students spend the first 2 years in Brookings, and then they transfer, and for the third and fourth year in a University of Minnesota degree. And that was a strategy that the previous dean created to expand the number of rural food and mixed animal veterinarians when we were landlocked in our capacity to admit additional students. We are working to expand our physical capacity so that we could increase our class size because we know that there's such a shortage.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Last testifier that we have on the list is Tina LeBrun from the Southern Agricultural Center of Excellence. Thanks for your patience. Get set up there, identify yourself, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the House Ag Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tina LeBrun, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Southern Agriculture Center of Excellence. And I'm here to speak about strong support for the continued and robust funding of the AGREET program within the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and to highlight the critical role of the Minnesota State Farm Business Management Program within that broader investment. I come before you today not just representing a program, but representing the farm families who make Minnesota's rural communities what they are. The people who anchor our local economies, who care for our soil and water, and who hold together the fabric of greater Minnesota. And today, these families need your support more than ever. The AGREET program represents one of Minnesota's most strategic commitments to our state's agriculture future. AGREET-funded initiatives such as the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council ensure the Minnesota farmers have access to innovation that helps them adapt to emerging challenges, conserve natural resources, and remain globally competitive. The continuation of this funding into the future ensures that Minnesota agriculture is not simply reacting to challenges, but preparing for them and leading through them. This is about the long view, about ensuring Minnesota farms are still here for the next generation. Within this broad landscape of agriculture education, the Minnesota State Farm Business Management Program, rather FBM, stands as one of the most effective, accessible, and farmer-centered tools we have for strengthening rural communities. The FBM program is where research comes alive through real-time data. The FBM program consists of 62 instructors hosted across 7 Minnesota State College campuses. These instructors work one-on-one with nearly 3,000 producers each year, providing individualized education in financial management, business planning, risk management, transition planning, and record keeping. These experts sit at kitchen tables with farm families, walk fields with them, and help them make decisions that can determine whether a farm survives another year. This is not classroom theory. It is practical, applied education rooted in the daily realities of Minnesota agriculture. And this program is reaching the farmers who need it most. 30% of producers enrolled in FBM are beginning farmers. That is not just a statistic, that is the future of Minnesota agriculture. This is a significant investment in succession planning, generational transition, and the long-term economic stability of rural Minnesota. Additionally, FBM provides one of the most comprehensive and accurate data sets on Minnesota farm financial trends. In fact, this data set leads the nation in farm financial benchmarking. Right now, FBM instructors are finalizing financials for nearly 2,470 producers for the upcoming 2025 annual report, which you will see on the screen. Early data shows that average net farm income will be an estimated $63,976 for the year 2025, compared to only $21,473 in 2024. This tells us two things. Yes, 2024 was a hard year. And yes, farmers are incredibly resilient. And programs like FBM give them financial clarity and business skills to weather that volatility. I want to speak directly to one of the most pressing issues facing agriculture today in farm transition. Minnesota is in the middle of one of the largest generational turnovers in our history. The decisions made in the next 5 to 10 years will determine the future of our rural communities for decades. This winter alone, we have served over 170 farmers and their families through our farm transition weekend retreats hosted by the Southern Ag Center in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I want to emphasize this. These families are showing up in record numbers because they are worried. Worried about how to keep their family farms intact, worried about fairness, worried about communication, and worried about whether the next generation will even be able to carry on the farm. At these retreats, we see grandparents, parents, and young producers all sitting together, sometimes for the first time, talking about the future of their farms. And through FBM, we help them turn fear into clarity and clarity into a plan. Farm transitions are not just financial decisions. They are emotional decisions. They are community decisions. They are environmental decisions. And they are decisions that determine whether family farms remain family farms. FBM instructors are trusted guides helping families navigate these incredibly challenging moments. You might be wondering why this work matters. Minnesota family farms are not just businesses. They are a heritage, they are an identity, they are the heart of rural Minnesota, and they're often a legacy. These farmers support our rural schools, keep our local businesses open, steward our fields, forests, and water, and maintain the economic and cultural foundation of our communities. When we invest in AGREET and FBM, we are investing in them and in the future of Minnesota. So in conclusion, I'm asking you today to continue your commitment to these programs because FBM ensures that farmers have the knowledge and confidence to apply that innovation, and because farm transition education ensures these farms remain in family hands for the next generation. Minnesota has always led the nation in agriculture innovation, stewardship, and I'm most proud, producer support. Within your continued investment, we will keep leading this together. Thank you for your continued commitment to Minnesota agriculture and for the opportunity to testify today. I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. LeBruin. Any questions from members? Last chance. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Yeah, the transition piece is a big piece that Minnesotans have to face in the near future, yes. So thank you very much. Last on the agenda, we have a presentation on the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota. And up is Dr. Mitch Hunter. And then we have Ariel Kagan and Paul Novotny. Welcome. Ooh, we have some cereal, it looks like. So when you're all plugged in, who's going to go first? Dr. Hunter?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Identify yourself and then begin.
Just waiting to see if my slides will come up here.
For each of us, I don't know.
Okay. My computer is thinking, so I'll get started. Perfect. Chair Anderson, Chair Hansen, members of the committee. My name, oops, jumped ahead on me. Jumped ahead again. My name is Mitch Hunter, and I am the co-director of the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. There are no bills in front of you today. Instead, we're just here to give you an update on our work. And we want to feed you. So we have cereal coming around in little cups. The other thing coming around in the little baggies, that's really not to eat. Paul Novotny will be speaking to that in a little bit. But coming around in the little cups is some cereal from a General Mills brand, Cascadian Farm. Here's what the box looks like. You can see Kernza emblazoned across the front in big letters. So this is their Honey Oat Crunch with Kernza and almonds. So I wanted to say, if you are allergic to nuts, please don't sample the cereal. But we're really excited that General Mills has launched this new line of cereals. This is one of four that are nationally distributed and that are bringing Kernza to consumers across the country. So thanks. And enjoy. Okay, so today I will be focusing on the outcomes in the state investments in Forever Green, and try to give examples of how we're leveraging that investment to bring in additional resources. Then you'll hear from two of our close partners, Ariel Kagan of the Minnesota Farmers Union and Paul Novotny, a farmer and entrepreneur who has benefited from MDA's program called Developing Markets for CLC Crops. In addition to these two great partners, I want to highlight that 30 groups have signed a new letter of support for our work, and I believe this was distributed prior to this hearing. Okay, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on Forever Green because I know that you know us well, but I just, in really brief, what we're doing is developing new crops that can cover the soil all year round. We call this continuous living cover, or CLC, agriculture. And then we're also developing new markets that can drive adoption and create economic opportunities for farmers. As we were just hearing, that's something that's in a lot of need right now. So. Before I dive into our report, I just want to note that we're not the only ones who think that CLC agriculture is important for Minnesota. So the recent nutrient reduction strategy states that CLC agriculture is essential to achieving our state's water quality goals, not on its own, but alongside BMP adoption and other strategies the state modeling is showing that CLC agriculture is really critical. I want to add to that and emphasize that our vision is that CLC agriculture will grow in a way that is voluntary and market-driven, not regulatory. So as you know, we work with over 15 different crops, and for the sake of time, I'm just going to use winter camelina as an example, as a case study today, so I'll briefly remind you about this crop. And that is the in the baggies coming around, so Paul will speak to that further, but that's the crop, the seeds that you're seeing in those little baggies. So in brief, this is a winter hardy oilseed. It's a brassica like canola. It fits within our current rotations, and currently on the landscape, we're in the pilot phase, early commercial of about 5,000 acres being grown. Some key benefits, so this really checks all the boxes environmentally. It protects our soil over the winter, improves soil health, reduces nitrate leaching, and feeds pollinators because it flowers en masse early in the spring. It also produces oil for low-carbon fuels, and that's an area with very rapidly growing demand. So it represents new market opportunity for farmers, but I would say the economic significance is really for the state as a whole. This could be a whole new industry, not just on the farm, but rooted in the farm and then ramifying out through the supply chain businesses, processors, end users, et cetera. Okay, so I'll come back to camelina shortly, and I believe that Ariel and Paul will speak to it as well. So that's why I kind of wanted to do camelina 101. Now I want to focus on specific outcomes from state investments, starting with AGREET, because after all, we're hearing about AGREET today. And so your support through AGREET has been very critical for Forever Green. It was passed a few years ago, and it enables consistent leadership. That includes my role, as well as our director of commercialization, as well as four of our breeders who are on soft funding. And these are the people who we need to have doing long-term, consistent science to make progress, to bring better cultivars of our crops to market for farmers to use. So that long-term support for them is very important. And in this two-year period where we've had AGREET funding, we've leveraged these funds over seven times over by securing additional private and state dollars. And there's an even bigger pot of federal money out there that we had in our hands, and it's currently on hold. So that leverage number would be more significant as well. We're still hopeful that that's going to come through. In addition to AGREET, we get support from the Clean Water Council and LCCMR. And so with this foundational state support over the last decade or so, we've built 15-plus crop development teams. We've trained 65 graduate students. We've released 8 crop varieties, including 4 that have come out within the last year, many more in the pipeline coming forward. And we've, to get there, we've funded nearly 100 research projects. This base that the state dollars has built has allowed us to leverage for some high-profile federal grants, many that have come in, as well as the one that we're still waiting on. And basically, this just multiplies the impact of the Minnesota tax dollars that are coming to us through those different avenues. We're also leveraging private industry dollars. And one great example is our partnership with Cargill, which is working to advance winter camelina and pennycress. There's two main parts of this. They gave us a philanthropic gift that's advancing basic and applied science that's necessary to build these industries. And we have a breeding partnership that has accelerated our breeding of winter camelina by over 100 times. So a very, very significant addition to our capacity. And all that adds up to better varieties for Minnesota farmers faster. In addition to developing these crops, we also are working with farmers to de-risk them and support adoption. And the Clean Water Council has made significant investments in our farmer adoption efforts. So we provide technical assistance and financial risk management to farmers through a program called ECO. And ECO is short for Economic and Environmental Clusters of Opportunity. Since 2021, when this program started, we have supported roughly 9,000 acres, about 200 fields, and roughly 80 growers who've been part of this program. And the program's growing. So we've been really excited to see this growth. We hope this continues. We've also been able to secure some private funding to build on the state capacity. And our ultimate goal is not that we cover every acre of Minnesota farmland through Minnesota state taxpayer dollars. We need to bridge to federal crop insurance programs. And so we're actively working to do that and make these crops normal. Just like corn and soybeans, you can go to your crop insurance agent, get a policy. That's what we should have for these crops as well, and that's what we're working towards. But farmer adoption doesn't go very far if there's no markets, right? And so that's why we're grateful that the state of Minnesota has invested in MDA's program called Developing Markets for CLC Crops. Like I mentioned, we'll hear more about the impact of that from Paul. And then we in Forever Green have leveraged those state dollars again with private dollars. So we've brought in $1.4 million over the past 2 years, and that's allowed us to continue engaging with partners like General Mills. So again, back to this cereal, They have this 1% Kernza initiative, put a little bit of Kernza in their four most popular cereals in this Cascadian Farm brand, so a little in a large volume, and that has added up to quadrupling their purchases of Kernza. Now, their main supplier is a Minnesota-based farmer-owned co-op, so that is benefiting that farmer enterprise by boosting their demand. It's boosting sales from that farmer co-op. In addition, we are leveraging these private dollars to develop programs that are targeting key market sectors. So we just are launching right now, actually the email and out today, launching our CLC Market Builders program. So that's aimed at the larger players, corporations, and really systematizing our engagement so we can have more corporate champions like General Mills. Just not too long ago, a few months ago, we launched our small and medium-sized enterprise program. So looking at the smaller companies that also have a key role to play in innovation, developing new products, and building markets. And so we're currently helping six companies launch new products that include crops like Kernza, hazelnuts, and elderberry. So that was a very quick rundown. I hope I've shown that we are how we are using state investment to make continuous living cover agriculture a real opportunity for Minnesota farmers, and that we're bringing in additional dollars to build on what this committee and other state entities have provided. To close, I'll return to Winter Camelina, and I just want to reflect that we're really lucky to be part of a large and growing coalition of partners who are working to advance Winter Camelina, some of whom are in the room today. And we're making real progress, but launching a brand new crop is exceedingly complex. So this is going to take significant coordinated investments all along the supply chain, farmers, supply chain companies, end users, and the public sector as well. The public benefits, the potential public benefits are huge. So this could be a new industry driving job creation in multiple sectors, a significant source of low carbon fuel and feed, a new cash crop for farmers, and the thing that got us into it, it's a highly scalable way to keep the soil covered all year round, protect our water, and feed pollinators. So we want to get this right. There's a lot at stake. And that's why we have gathered together our partners to launch the 1 million acres of winter camelina scaling study. That's a mouthful, so our acronym is OneMAS. And then I'll turn it over to Ariel Kagan to tell us about that study.
Go ahead, ma'am. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ariel Kagan. I'm the Director of Climate and Working Lands at Minnesota Farmers Union. I'm here today to speak about our interest in winter camelina, which Dr. Hunter just spoke about, and to update you on this current project, the Winter Camelina 1 Million Acre Scaling Study, or OneMAS, which is really looking at different pathways for scaling camelina acres to a million at some point in the future in the state of Minnesota, and what it would take to get there. As we heard, winter camelina is a promising crop that can diversify farmers' income streams while protecting soil and water. It can be a feedstock for more sustainable biofuels and can reduce emissions, which is critical for our state's climate goals. Winter camelina can also have valuable co-product uses, especially for animal feed. The OneMAS study is a year-long cross-sector effort to create a roadmap for industry, farmers, government, and NGOs on scaling the first 1 million acres of winter camelina, and it's led by the University of Minnesota Forever Green Initiative, as well as Greater MSP's Embold Coalition. And the study is co-chaired by Minnesota Farmers Union and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. The project launched in the fall of 2025 and has engaged a team of experts to conduct research in three areas: policy and market research, farmer economics, and carbon intensity modeling. The project is engaging a broad group of stakeholders that includes private sector companies, including seed companies, agronomy, inputs, distribution, and consumer product goods, as well as farmers, commodity groups, state agencies, NGOs, and researchers. The project is ongoing currently, but some preliminary outcomes include the importance of ongoing research and development, farmer adoption support, and support for scaling. Winter camelina has a promising growth opportunity, and continuing to improve the crop's competitiveness through breeding and agronomy will be a key driver of scaling. Sustaining support from the state of Minnesota to improve winter camelina and de-risk farmer adoption is important in achieving success and scale, and this committee and the Department of Agriculture has had and will continue to have an important role to play in supporting the development of infrastructure on farms and in the supply chain. This OneMAS project will be completed in the fall of 2026 this year, and will lay out what would need to happen to successfully scale Winter Camelina to its first 1 million acres in the years ahead. We look forward to sharing the results with you and other partners in this work. Thank you for the opportunity to share about this project, and we look forward to continued partnership with the University of Minnesota Forever Green Initiative and others in this effort. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Cagle. Can you give us any idea of the numbers with Camelina, like potential yield and price, that type of thing? That's a lot of acres to attract. How are we going to do that?
Mr. Chair, I would let Dr. Hunter answer the question on yield particularly.
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. So we have two sources of data about yield. We have research trials and we have on-farm experience. And they're not too far apart. There are some differences. So in research trials, we have seen yields up to about 1,500 pounds per acre. In very rough terms, you can imagine that's about half what spring wheat would yield. So less than one of the main crops, but still significant for a crop that's growing in the off season. We know genetically that it can go significantly higher than 1,500 pounds per the acre, and so that's what we're driving towards with better breeding and better agronomy. What we've seen on farms, and our first 2 years of the Cargill collaboration were two really hard years, really dry falls, variable temperature in the winter, you know, kind of worst case scenario. The first year, I think our average yield was around 700 pounds to the acre. Second year is about 900 pounds to the acre. So, of course, weather's a factor. It's also a learning curve, and Paul could speak to that. It's a brand new crop. You saw the bags come around. Those seeds are very small. So we know that farmers are going to go through a learning curve, and there might have been a lot more yield in those fields than what ended up in the combine just because it's nothing like a corn or soybean seed. So what we want to do, that 900 is kind of what we're building our modeling around, because we know that's achievable. We don't want to have all these rosy assumptions, but we're also looking at scenarios of how quickly and how high can we get the yield up. On the price side, Cargill is the one that's been setting the price through their contract that they've put out, and the price has been around $25 per 100 pounds, per 100 weight. 25 cents a pound is another way to think about it, and I don't remember the conversion in my mind to a per bushel price, unfortunately. They're basically looking at soybeans and canola, which are similar in their market profile. They make oil, they make meal, and essentially discounting it a bit they're pegging it to that price. I think they're actually putting a small premium on the canola price, if I remember correctly. So.
And I've seen a demonstration of Camelina. In everything, if everything works right, you can get three crops in a two-year period, correct?
That's correct. Yes, thank you, Chair. Would you like me to say more about that?
Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't go into that because I didn't want to, you know, have a 10-minute lecture on how to grow Camelina, but...
Well, don't do 10 minutes.
I won't.
It was a short version.
Short version is Camelina thrives best when it is planted following a crop that is harvested a little earlier and has less residue than some of our main crops. So corn and soybeans are usually harvested pretty late, and corn especially leaves behind a ton of residue. So... spring wheat or other small grains harvested earlier, usually the residue is largely removed. And silage corn, similarly, harvested a little bit earlier. Ideal planting time for Camelina in the fall is kind of mid-September through sometimes as late as mid-October. It can go pretty late. Now, Ann Schwegel, who's the vice president of the Farmers Union and one of the winter Camelina growers who's come back year after year, on their farm, they're planting it actually after soybeans, an earlier harvested soybean. So no surprise, farmers are going to figure out creative ways to farm it. But kind of the baseline system that we're talking about is you plant it following a small grain or silage corn. It establishes in the fall, grows over the winter. And then simple approach is you harvest it in late June, early July, and then plant a second crop in that year. So you have some options if you're planting in the beginning of July. But you don't have as many options as what farmers typically would want. If you're planting soybeans at that time, you're looking at a 30 to 50% yield loss from a traditional soybean. That's not acceptable. The economics don't work. So to overcome that soybean yield reduction, the system that we're working on, we've done it many times on research stations, and we have an increasing number of farmers who've done it successfully, is to actually plant the soybeans into the Camelina. So when you plant the Camelina in the fall, instead of just solid seeding it across the field,
every 30 inches you leave a skip row. So there's a bigger gap in the field. And then you come back in the spring, normal soybean planting time, you plant your beans into those skip rows. So that gives the beans a little bit more space, a little bit more light, a little bit more access to water, et cetera, to get started. And they'll be, you know, when it's time to harvest the camelina, it'll be this tall. Hopefully your beans are about this tall, and you can just pick up the head of your combine and scalp the seeds off the top of the camelina plants because they're mostly held at the top of the canopy there. So it's complicated. It's not the easy button. It's not the standard approach to farming. But as you said, when that works, you can get those three crops in 2 years. You might have a 10 to 15% yield reduction on soybeans. But if you have a good camelina harvest, you by far more than make up for it, produce the same amount of protein, if not more, and 50% more oil per acre. And we're in a situation globally where there's a big growing demand for vegetable oil from farms. So adding that oil per acre is really essential to the whole value proposition of this crop.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Novotny, identify yourself and proceed.
Chairman, members, I'm Paul Novotny. I'm from Chatfield, Minnesota, and I work at my family's trucking and storage business and also farm 1,700 acres. And I've also been on the Chatfield City Council for the last 20 years, which is where I was introduced to some forever green crops more than 10 years ago when we were studying our drinking water management area. Since then, I've grown both Kernza and winter camelina. And for the last year, I've spent my time focused on camelina for many reasons. First, there's a solid end user market. It's fall seeded and acts as a cover crop, and it has strong potential to diversify my cropping rotation. As a grower, though, I've experienced many things that go wrong with planting something new. I harvested my first crop and ended up with the mess that you saw in one of those bags and wondering what I got myself into and how I was going to clean it. And I figured out pretty fast I was kind of on my own at the time. I've also experienced a total loss and partial loss from winter kill. And that brings me to the first of two programs that I've been involved with that you have previously funded and how critical that has been in getting us this far. First is the ECO program. It has been vital in de-risking growing these crops as failures sometimes happen and as we can continue to define best practices and build on our current successes. Winter camelina appears to have a fairly strong end user market, and year over year, more growers are interested in growing it. But the supply chain, in my opinion, still needs work. Three things stand out: a cleaning option, a short-term storage option, and possibly a drying option. As most growers, at least by me, their setups are designed for corn and soybeans, I think this could be a limiting factor in the scaling process for growers have setups to handle traditional row crops. The second program, the supply chain grant through the MDA, has been and will be equally important in creating some solutions that don't exist today and how it has made a difference so far. 2 years ago, I received a $50,000 grant to set up a grain cleaning site, a grain cleaner, and a site in Chatfield, and I chose to purchase a mobile cleaner, or one that could be possibly mobile, for $89,000. And I also last fall received a second grant to upgrade that unit to be fully self-contained so that it, with its own power source, so while maintaining a site in Chatfield, it can also now be pulled to any site. Last summer, the cleaner was utilized by multiple growers cleaning roughly 400,000 pounds of seed, and in this last January, cleaned 50,000 pounds from Montana. Now with at least one seed cleaner available, and if some short-term regional storage and drying options become available, I think we will get even more growers to consider planting for evergreen crops when there is more post-harvest support in place for when the harvest doesn't go as planned or you don't have the correct infrastructure for this small seed. In closing, looking back at the two crops that I planted starting in 2015 when I first planted Kernza and the 10 short years where the market is today, and now with winter camelina and its growth potential, with continued state support for supply chain and new crop development, it'll be exciting to see what the future holds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Novotny. Questions from members? No questions? I just add one thing that I had heard. Again, I had done some research into camelina. And you better take your duct tape out and make sure you have no little holes in your truck, because that little seed will come right running out, wouldn't it? Do you find that to be true? Mr. Novotny?
Mr. Chairman, members, yeah, so that's defining best practices, right? We're working through that. So put it in context, I know some growers are in the 700 to 900 range. I've been in the 14 to 1800 pound range an acre. But also at the same time, when we plant this, we're using 6 to 8 pounds an acre, which is three times the size of that bag. That's what we apply on the ground to grow it. And we're getting vastly more than that. So my first lesson was I harvested, didn't exactly know what I was doing, harvested the crop, planted Kernza following this crop, because that's one of the things that you can do. The next spring, I realized I had Kernza and Camelina. So I started paying attention to that. If you start to look at it, you could leave behind 100 or more pounds if you don't prepare your combine, compare the head, you know, do all the stuff, because it's less than coffee grounds. It just falls right out of a normal machine. But yeah.
Interesting. Thank you. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick here. I noticed the map. I'm looking at Roseau County. I know a lot of folks up in my area have tried this in far northwest Minnesota. Could you comment a little bit about just regionally what you're seeing? You talked about winter kill. I'm just curious what things look like. I haven't talked to anybody specifically up there, but I'm curious what that would look like up there.
Dr. Hunter?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Burkle. Thank you for the question. We have seen success all across the state. And kind of counterintuitively, we have seen fewer problems with winter kill way up north. Two reasons. One is that it just gets cold and stays cold, typically, where in the south you have a lot more fluctuations, and that can confuse the plant, and it starts to go reproductive in the fall. So that's been the biggest cause of winter kill. We've seen when it's planted at the right time, winter camelina is equally hardy as winter rye, which almost every year, you're guaranteed it's going to survive. Last winter, both winter rye and winter camelina had more winter kill than you would have expected. It was just that hard of a winter. We saw lots of perennials die that you typically have no issue with. So last winter was really, really bad. But up north, you don't have that fluctuation. You tend to get maybe a little bit more consistent snow cover. So we've seen that success, and we're starting to adjust based on that real world experience, starting to adjust our planting date guidance for further south. So basically, we just need to move it further back. The very first year we had this on 2,000 acres, we were all excited, and some of our farmers were really on the ball and got it planted early, which typically is a good thing. They're the ones who suffered because it just had a little bit too much time to grow in the fall. So we've just started to tweak that and move it back. And I'm very optimistic about this winter, both because we're dialing in some of those BMPs, and the conditions have been pretty favorable. So looking forward to seeing what happens this spring.
Follow up, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. And I'm also curious, you know, you're talking about expansion of acres. Could you maybe just comment a little more on your partnerships as far as you can't expand to that degree without the marketing going along with it? And I appreciate hearing about the Cargill, the General Mills partnerships you've got going on for marketing. We heard last week a lot of demonizing of big companies like that, but if you're going to make an expansion of that size, you've got to market the product. Could you comment a little on that?
Dr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle, absolutely. So it says here on the slide, our attitude is that we're building a village. We absolutely can't do this on our own outside of or out of the university. And when you're talking about a crop with this kind of scale potential and the types of markets that we're aiming at, fuel and large-scale feed, it's not going to be an artisanal crop. There may be artisanal uses, direct marketing uses. The oil is absolutely edible, can be used for cooking, can be used for a lot of different things. And we would 100% support any of that. That's all positive. That's rural entrepreneurship, you know, creating jobs and income. But to get to the scale that we're talking about of 1 million acres and beyond, we do think that there's potential to go beyond. It's going to have to be through large markets. And so, you know, we're working with a small farmer-owned co-op of organic growers on the Kernza side. We're working with Cargill on the Camelina side. And essentially our philosophy is we're trying to advance continuous living cover, keep the soil covered all year round. If there's a group that wants to do that with us and has something to contribute,
we'll be pragmatic, we'll work with them. And so, you know, Cargill is huge. They're playing the role of creating the market for farmers, putting out the contract, making it way easier for farmers to say, yes, I'm going to grow this crop, versus something speculative or a partner who they can't trust to actually pay their bill, right? So that's really big. But they can't do it alone either, right? And so you see on the slide here, AURI, really critical partner, Embold, they're helping us think about the meal side of it, which Cargill is doing as well, but what do you do with the meal? What are the end-use markets? How do you add value there? Because it all has to add up. You're never going to make it work on the oil alone. You have to have both contributing to the economics. And then through Embold, Compeer has come to the table to help us think about crop insurance and risk management. Because, again, farmers are not going to do this at scale without that kind of a backstop. We want, essentially with Camelina, we want this to be as normal of a crop as possible. It should just be something that you grow because there's a market. It fits into your system, and it's contributing to the economy of your farm. And then you feel really good about all the benefits that it has for your soil and the water at the same time. This is not going to scale to 100,000 acres, much less a million or more, if it's just a feel-good thing, right? So luckily, with this crop, those environmental benefits are very deeply baked into just the biology of the species and how it works on a farm. And so at this point, we're always going to keep an eye to that, but our big challenge is to reach scale and make an impact in that way. And we think that if we do, some of these longstanding challenges that our state has faced, like trying to reduce nitrate losses being a big one, we can actually move the needle on that. It can be a different picture in 20 years than it is today. And that would be a really massive contribution. So that's kind of how we have our eye on the prize.
Thank you. See no further questions. Thank you to our testifiers. Interesting program today. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Next meeting coming up Wednesday with Chair Hanson.